Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Dave McGowan about his book Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Laurel Canyon, Covert Ops, and the Dark Heart of the Hippie Dream. We are also talking a little bit about the lie of free love and peace, the contrived music industry, the hippie movement overall, and of course we're going to get into a little bit more of that, and also the drug connection, the cultural revolution here a bit later too. There's a lot of interesting stuff here, a lot of interesting material. But just carrying on forward here from where we left off, Dave, though, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about how you perceived this to have spread at the time, because surely this can have not just have been by word of mouth. I mean, people showing up to see, you know, Vito and the freaks and everything else. There must have been a tremendous promotional effort around all of this. I mean, the press, of course, reviews. You said, I think, that one of the radio stations were set up specifically to start promoting kind of this, but a tremendous concerted effort to get this thing off the ground. Press, were they involved? Other media outlets, radio, television, etc.?
A lot of these people actually made very high profile TV appearances. Back in those days. And not just on music related shows. I mean, some of them, like one of the bands, like appeared on like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. or something like. And these, so they were getting TV work, you know. And of course, these are people that were supposed to view as sort of enemies of the state to some extent, people that were a thorn in the side of the establishment, so to speak. And yet, what you find is that they were, by and large, almost all signed to major, huge record labels, Capitol and Columbia in particular. These weren't people that were signing with like these, you know, little mom and pop startup, firms. They were being signed by the biggest guys on the block and being promoted by the mainstream media in newspapers, in magazines, in print, or on the radio. TV. I mean, they were getting exposure from all avenues of the mainstream media, despite the fact that, you know, these are people that you would think the mainstream media would kind of want to suppress their voices, but instead, this was very much a corporate undertaking as far as the, you know, who was signing these bands and who was actively promoting them. It was all big, major corporate entities, basically, that was doing that. It was not being done on a grassroots level by any stretch of the imagination at all. So I don't know if that fully answers your...
Oh, certainly. No, I'm thinking about how, how the communication here within must have occurred, right? Because it's always interesting to analyze the networks, how trends, spread and how it gets picked up. And of course... unfortunately, people by default are followers. They're whatever the attention and the focus is. That's where they'll kind of attract to. It's very unfortunate, but if there's a tie in here between, it's not only military. Obviously, military might be behind, of course, of arranging the backdrop to all of this. But then you have an interface with the private world as well, if you will, right? With media stations, you have producers and everything else. And have you managed to get closer to any of the names that might have been like personally responsible in pulling the strings of getting all of this together?
Not really, no. I'm not the kind of guy that most people really want to talk to too much.
Why not?
I tried to get right now as we speak, the Grammy Museum right here in LA, in conjunction with the Getty Center, two of the biggest museum entities here in LA, are actually staging a Laurel Canyon exhibit for the first time. They're staging an exhibit to raise awareness of this scene. It was announced several months ago that beginning in May. And my book was just released on April 30th, and it was announced that beginning in May that, there were some articles in the paper and quotes from people saying that, we think it's time after all these years that we shine a little light on our own backyard. You know, we've highlighted all these other things, and now it's time that we shine a little light on our own thing that happened here. So it started last month and is running through August, I think, which was just really bizarre because they scheduled this thing to to debut literally within days of the official release date of my book. And when I heard about it, I was just like, wow, this is like a gift from the gods. I mean, what better marketing opportunity could there be? You know, here the Grammy Museum right here in town is putting on this new exhibit, specifically shining light on this scene. And, you know, there's gotta be some kind of a way I can tie my book in here and whatnot. And I contacted them, and they had a very serious lack of interest.
Oh, really? Yeah, of course.
And then, you know, once they finally got the exhibit going, and you know, they ran some articles on it, and I realized that this was done in very close conjunction with a lot of these artists and or their estates in the cases where the artists are no longer with us. And you know, that they have like Graham Parsons' nudie suit on display and somebody else's guitar and, you know, the piano that so-and-so wrote this song at. And so they had to work in very close conjunction with these artists and artist representatives to put this show together. So, there's no way in the world that they were going to work with me, you know, because there's no way that these artists would have cooperated if they had known that I was going to be involved in any way, shape, or form in this. Because I'm pretty sure that, that none of them really want to have too much to do with me. You know, I say it right explicitly in the preface to the book that it is not my intention to serve as a publicist for the estates of Jim Morrison and John Phillips and, you know, whatnot. And nor is it my intention to, you know, recite the same tired apocryphal stories that have been, you know, written a dozen times before. And, you know, if that's the kind of book you're looking for, there's plenty of that out there,
sure.
But that's not what you're going to find here, you know? So,
Yeah,
I mean, I, you know, other people that have written on the scene have interviewed and talked to and gotten close to, you know, the artists who were involved. And to me, there's a serious compromise of journalistic integrity in doing so, because they're not going to work with you. They're not going to let you get close unless they have a pretty good guarantee that they're going to be painted in a flattering light.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, of course.
And I like to have the freedom to call things exactly as I see them. And, so that kind of really precludes me from actually being able to, interview these actual participants face to face. Cause yeah, I'm just not really the kind of guy they want.
Well, that's why we're independent. You can run your own course and follow your own tracks and actually get to the truth of the matters, you know, because it's really important. But let's talk a little bit more about how you see that this was used, and again, in terms of, I think that there's a number of components of why they wanted to hijack, first of all, a natural tendency at the time, of course, with the anti-war movement and all that. We had a certain crowd beginning with this, and then at some point, this, what you've been describing, comes into the picture. But I also see it much more than that. I mean, if we think about it, the whole idea of upsetting culture has been a tremendously important factor in trying to, derail kind of, you know, parent-child relationships of state taking over schooling, etc. This is a new aspect to that, as I see it, with so-called, you know, revolutionary music, right? Counterculture. You have a revolution within the culture. It's completely new clothes. People have never seen stuff like this before. Hairstyles, even the way people talk. Of course, with this, you have drugs and all kinds of other things kind of latching onto it, which creates a completely, a different human, really, than we've seen before. And the way that this took off and was successful, I mean, it's just tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we almost had kind of a whole new language develop, you know, we're groovy and far out and, you know, turn on, tune in and drop out and, you know, all of these sort of catchphrases and whatnot. And, it was a radical change, you know, from the previous generations, to, you know, I wasn't alive in the 50s, but from what I hear, it was a pretty conservative, straight-laced kind of era, and And this, yeah, so there was just really a sea change in terms of hairstyles and facial hair and clothing and kind of type of music and the type of attitudes that people had towards drugs and sex. And yeah, it was just a huge, huge cultural revolution. And these people were, and so these people were, you know, people like David Crosby, Stephen Stills, Jim Morrison, whatnot. I mean, they were far more than just the entertainers for that era. They were far more than just singers or just songwriters or whatever. They basically became very quickly the spokesmen and the leaders of an entirely new youth generation that a really revolutionarily new cultural phenomenon that they were very much the spokesmen and the leaders of, which, you know, gave them a considerable amount of power. So, you know, it's not really hard on that level to understand why the powers that be would have a desire to control those voices.
Yeah, because if they want to use them in that way, right? I mean, with power comes influence and, of course, responsibility. That wasn't, I guess, not really in the picture. It was more about kind of derailing responsibility, as I say it. And, I mean, even if we go back to the 50s there as well, this was also a very contrived and packaged version that arose after World War II. And I think if we want to go to some kind of truth when it comes to the family unit and core culture and everything else, you have to go back before World War II. I mean, I think we saw a worldwide reformation of everything after the Second World War. Everything changes after that point. And from that point on, we've kind of lost all connection with some kind of true tradition, really. And I mean, look at us now. We're in this kind of weird corporate, culture, and everything is just very shallow and everything else. I mean, I see this as a weapon, Dave. It's weaponized propaganda. I can't see it any other way. And we've seen multiple inventions in the last, 30, 40 years of renewal of these processes. I mean, how do you even view, considering what you know of the past here in the 60s and 70s, maybe a little bit, how do you even view some of the music scenes that's going on today? I mean, how controlled is not that, you know?
Oh, I think it's far more controlled today. I mean, yeah, it's, and since you asked, one of the questions that I get quite a bit is along the lines of, so are you basically saying that these people were a bunch of no talent hacks and they were just maneuvered into place because of who they were and their family connections and whatnot? And no, I'm not saying that, because I do recognize that some of these people were phenomenally talented. And, like I say, some of them did not know what they were doing at first, but a lot of them did develop into very respectable, artists. And some of them were just phenomenally talented. People like Frank Zappa was, hugely respected as a composer, as a multi-instrumentalist, an arranger, a producer. He had a very autocratic style. He wasn't a real popular guy to work with, but phenomenally talented. Brian Wilson was just in every way, shape, and form, as a songwriter, singer, multi-instrumentalist. He was given like complete creative control over his music at like the age of like 19 or something like that. It was just absolutely unprecedented. He was like 19 and his brothers were like 16 and 17 or something like that. Mm. And he was given full creative control over his music. He a producer, arranger, composer. Just amazingly, phenomenally talented guy. So no, I am not saying that they were no talent hacks, but what I am saying is that a hugely disproportionate number of them came directly from the military intelligence world. And that can't be a coincidence. They weren't the only talented guys, aspiring to be rock stars in that era. During that time, every kid in the country was growing their hair out and picking up a guitar and wanting to be a rock star, The question becomes, were they really the only ones who who had that talent, or were they just the ones who were handpicked to be promoted into that level of fame and recognition, you know? So I'm not saying that they are untalented. I am, though. I would, though, say that now there is a huge disconnect between talent and fame and recognition. I mean, just like wildly disproportionate, you know. We're now in an era where these stars seem to emerge from just out of nowhere, prepackaged. You know, you get these Miley Cyruses or Lady Gagas or Beyoncés or, you know, whatever, on and on, Justin Biebers. And they just seem to come out of nowhere, you know, as these fully formed stars with an image and a sound and an army of handlers, and in no time at all they're putting up you know, YouTube videos that get tens of millions of hits, and they have millions of Twitter followers around the world. And I mean, it'd be very hard to argue that that's due just strictly to their talent, you know.
It's exposure. So again, and that's my point, that someone is, I mean, when you start promoting people, then more and more people are looking towards that and amassing towards that, you know, central point. And that's what's so unfortunate here as well. It's like, it seems that they promote it, and that's why they become big artists. It's not the other way around, that they're talented and through, you know, slow work and word of mouth, they get big. It's all about promotion. It's all about PR these days, you know?
Yeah, and we're always told that they're self-made, you know. Oh, Madonna, she was just such a brilliant self-promoter. That's why she, you know, and same with Lady Gaga. And I'm like, I don't think so. These people have whole armies of handlers standing behind them, you know. It's just, I'm not buying that. So, yeah, I mean, the 60s are really kind of a golden era in comparison, because, you know, whether or not you choose to believe that these artists were controlled, they certainly had talent, and the music that they made stands to this day as some of the best you know, popular music ever created. And nowadays, it seems like we've reached a point where talent is really kind of secondary at best, and all that's really needed is a marketable face and image, and they can make you a star like overnight. You know, practically, I mean, this huge international star just out of very, very little actual talent, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the star machine, making machine, has been refined to such a point now that the talent's really kind of secondary, you know? It's
I mean, with all the pitch shifts and whatever, the, you know, voice operated things they have at their disposal, it doesn't really matter. It's all mimed. It's all, you know, it's all for show in that regard. So it's become really, really boring. But
yeah, they all use that technology. What do they call it? Auto-tune?
Auto-tune,
like
exactly.
That,
That's what I was thinking about. It's horrible. Ugh.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's really reached a really sad state. It really has. So, I mean, the stuff coming out of the 60s seems really almost kind of quaint.
it does. Nonetheless, how bad it might have been, and the nefarious purposes behind it, it still has gone through such a refining process now that it's just pure evil coming out of the other end of that star machine today. You know, I can't view it on
it is.
Any other way.
And the symbolism is just so blatant, so in your face.
Sure.
You know, in all of these, the videos and any of these real high profile live performances, like the award shows and the Super Bowl halftime, and more and more in recent years, they've just become kind of these showcases for, how much blatant symbolism you can throw in there.
Yeah.
And there's whole websites now that are dedicated specifically to you know, detailed analysis of this symbolism. And you don't have to drop acid and spin your records backwards anymore to find the symbolism. It's right there in your face, you know?
And they're riding the wave on that too. The producers know very well how this picks up, and it's all very much kind of homogenous, like promotion package today, because they know how this stuff takes off. And I mean, look at some of the Gaga performances and everything, and Cyrus and everything. I mean, it's like borderline, you know, they're drinking blood on stage. It's more or less pornographic straight out now. You know, it's just about amassing as much attention as you can as possible to kind of pierce through that veil of the, what do they call it? The noise veil or something like that, of trying to beat all the other artists and advertisers out there, and the more they're trying to do that, the more they have to kind of sharpen that tip of the edge, you know, and really try to make something which is really disturbing to people, so that they'll pierce through.
Yeah, there's a lot of occult and violent imagery swirling around, and one of the most disturbing developments is what seems to be like an ongoing effort to sexualize children, you know, you have these, it's such a well-worn pattern now that, you know, you get these very clean cut, freshly scrubbed Disney stars like, Britney Spears or more recently Miley Cyrus, who both started out in the, you know, squeaky clean, Disney world. I'm pretty sure. I think Britney Spears was a Mouseketeer, and
she was.
Cyrus was, of course, Hannah Montana or whatever on the Disney Channel.
Yeah,
and they gather these huge followings of these preteen girls, and then like as soon as they hit their 18th birthday, all of a sudden they're practically performing like porn stars.
Sure,
you know.
Yeah,
and that all seems very deliberate to me. You know,
absolutely.
And very disturbing.
Exactly. It's about, and I mean, I see that as a slow progression. I mean, that's why this discussion is so interesting, because I see that as innocent as it was back in the 60s with the hippie movement, it was still, the tendencies for that was still there at that stage. Now we've just transgressed that. It's a sliding scale from there to where we are today, although it's much worse today, but it's still on the same level, right? It's about not only drug use, but it's about over-sexualization of everything and free love, right? It's all about kind of using sex as a tool of, as I see it anyway, you know, promiscuity as a kind of a control. It harkens back to some of the psychological ideas that come out earlier in the 20th century about how everyone is sexually oppressed, etc. So this is somehow now supposed to liberate us, right? It's all kind of weaved in there, isn't it?
Yeah, very much. I mean, one of the byproducts of the 60s music scene, which Frank Zappa actually played a huge role in nurturing, was the birth of so-called groupies, super groupies, which didn't really exist before then, and suddenly, yeah, you had all of these very young, often underage girls just basically throwing themselves at band members, you know, anybody in a band, you know? And Frank Zappa was a huge part of that, you know. I mean, he was an integral part of the Plastercasters, the notorious, you know, Cynthia Plastercaster and her crew that were running around doing their thing, and he formed quite a few of the groupies around him and formed a band out of them, the GTOs, which didn't last very long, but. So yeah, he was a huge player in that, in launching the whole groupie phenomenon that continues to this day, but that was probably at its heyday in the 60s with, you know, Pamela I don't even know how to pronounce her last name, but all of these super groupies, some of whom became kind of mini celebrities themselves, you know, like Cynthia Plastercaster and Pamela whatever. Debar, I don't know how you pronounce her name, but so yeah, that was another outgrowth. It was this underage girls chasing band members around phenomenon.
Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah, it's pretty nasty stuff, and of course look at where it's gotten us today, you know. So good job, people. Now, if we go back for a moment before we proceed and talk a little more, you have an interesting, of course, chapter there on never being, won't get fooled again. I want to talk a little bit more about that later, how things progress from there. But nonetheless, if we go back to the Laurel Canyon era a little bit more there, where were some of the studios that they did some of this stuff? I mean, I know about, for example, you know, The Mansion, Rick Rubin, a lot of the modern stuff has been done there, you know, Red Hot Chili Peppers and a lot of other music too, but is what kind of environment was there with the studios? How controlled were the producers of the music scene, and who was behind that?
That's a good question. You know, I mean, and there wasn't a huge number of people. It doesn't seem like, you know, some of the biggest names were Paul Rothchild, who produced
The Doors,
The Doors and Love, and
Now, is he a member of the actual Rothschild family, or is it because some are allegedly just have that name and are not related to the
supposedly the not. Yeah. His name does not have the S in it. It's spelled differently, right. And he supposedly is not. You know, I mean, it's you never really know. You know, I mean, it's possible that that branch of the family changed the spelling to throw people off the track. You know, it's hard to say. I'm the new project that I've been working on now for several months is the Lincoln assassination, and one of the things that I've discovered is that, you know, how many prominent people to this day are directly related to John Wilkes Booth and the Booth family, like Tony Blair's wife, Sherry Blair, who was born a Booth, a direct descendant of John Wilkes Booth's uncle. Hmm. Her maiden name was... I can't remember now, but anyways, Booth. But then, even more recently, I discovered that Claire Booth Luce, who was the wife of Henry Luce, who founded Time Magazine, Life Magazine, Sports Illustrated, Fortune. You know, he was a Skull and Bones man, and on and on and on. You know, very well connected. A longtime intelligence operative, as was she. And I recently discovered that she also is a descendant of the Booth clan, but they changed the name years ago and added an E to it to throw people off, specifically to distance themselves from John Wilkes Booth and the rest of the Booth clan. But they are in fact blood relatives of the very same family. So it's not unknown for some branch of the family to do that, to make minor spelling variations to make it appear that they aren't part of the family. So officially, according to all official accounts, he was not a member of the Rothschild family. But you know, again, it's possible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting, that whole thing there, when I did some research on the doors and the Lizard King, right? It's all this kind of symbolism behind there and the way that they were launched and everything. How about the drug portion of this then, and how much was that kind of tied into it too? I mean, it's a lot of work been done now on, you know, LSD, you know, distribution, kind of a, not maybe a hands-on mind control in that sense, but kind of to make your mind more malleable, shall we say, to the conditions that existed at the time. It was very beneficial to kind of break down some of the innate barriers that you do have against some of the stuff using drugs. What's your angle on this?
Well, there was certainly a lot of that going around. And, especially at any of the big high profile events, there was acid being freely distributed, usually cooked up by Owsley, this guy by the name of Owsley, who once again comes from a long line of military intelligence types and has a rather illustrious family history and himself worked in radio intelligence before becoming the country's premier acid chemist. And he's the guy that cooked up a lot of these just massive batches of acid, and he would go to and distribute it freely, like tens of thousands of hits at like the Human Being, at Monterey Pop Festival, at Altamont, and all of these big high-profile concerts and whatnot, and events, whether in L.A. or San Francisco. They routinely would provide free LSD, you know, which is kind of weird. Just be giving away just literally thousands of dollars worth of, and his rationale always was that he just wanted to turn on the world, supposedly. He was just a very benevolent figure that thought this was just such an enlightening experience that he wanted as many people as possible to experience it. So he was willing to, you know, cook up these massive batches of LSD and give it away, you know, give it freely away. But, given his background and family history, it would be fairly easy to conclude that his motives might not have been all that benevolent.
Exactly.
And that basically what they were running at events like Woodstock and Altamont and Monterey or whatnot were these big giant open air MK Ultra experiments, basically, you know, where they had these, especially at Woodstock, where these people were basically trapped there for like 3 days in these appalling conditions with, you know, non-functioning bathrooms and lack of food and lack of water and sleep deprivation for several days and just pumping them full of acid and rock music, you know.
Jeez.
I mean, it just looks very much like a big giant open air experiment, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I agree with you. What do you think the motive of these experiments are? Is it to dislodge, you know, people from their culture? Again, usually there's never only the one item which they're trying to achieve. I think it's a multiple set of goals, of course, but one of the items you mentioned is to kind of derail the legitimate anti-war, you know, protests that started to arise at the time. But then there seems to be more after, kind of latching on after that. They probably realized at some point how successful this was and decided to turn it into, pedal to the metal. Let's see how far we can go with this thing, right? That seems to me what they were doing, a live experiment almost.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of disagreement among, you know, those who have done a lot of conspiracy research. I mean, most people who have dug very deeply into it generally agree that it was deliberately introduced, you know, into the population after being initially tested covertly, that it was, you know, deliberately introduced. But there's considerable debate over the effectiveness. You know, a lot of people seem to think that it was a government ploy that backfired, that these were introduced to control the population and instead serve to enlighten and sort of liberate the population. I would tend to kind of disagree with that assessment. I think it actually was pretty successful the rallying cry of the acid crowd was turn on, tune in, and drop out. You know, I mean, that's what Leary and others were specifically telling people. I mean, at some events, Leary specifically told people, turn your back on the war, you know. The whole hippie idea was sort of the commune kind of idea that you can't fix the war, you know, you can't fix the world, so let's just all retreat to our own little private nirvana, and we can create this beautiful world for ourselves, you know, which is all well and good, but that's not going to stop a war, you know? I mean, having all the people who would oppose the war go off and hang out in communes and decide to turn on, tune in, and drop out is not a formula for stopping the war. It's exactly the opposite. So, I think it was more successful than a lot of people seem to think. And it certainly couldn't have been a coincidence that it was legal, like up until what, like 1967 or something like that.
Through the
first few years of this whole Cultural Revolution, they didn't even they had very strict laws against like pot and pills and all these other things that were arguably considerably less strong a drug and less dangerous a drug than LSD. And yet LSD wasn't even criminal. It was perfectly legal for the first few years of this whole movement. And that can't really be by accident that they allowed that one particular drug, you know, hallucinogenic drugs are really like nothing else. It's really you can't even describe the experience to someone who hasn't experienced it. I mean, it's a whole nother level of drug experience, really. So for them to leave that particular drug legal while outlawing many other, you know, virtually everything else.
Do you think that a lot of this then is to kind of disconnect from the active contributions to society to a certain extent? I mean, I'm personally not maybe one who would promote engagement in a lot of the phony dialectical systems that we have out there. But still, at the same time, there's something to be said for the fact of actually trying to participate in what we do have and try to improve things and try at least to make things not just kind of completely slide down the scale and you know, as we're circling the drain, if as it were. I mean, there has to be a kind of a participation in the society, right? If they manage to sever No, they didn't manage to do it with the whole generation, of course, but a lot of people were so popular, the whole hippie. I mean, it spread to the rest of the world. My dad was into all these groups that you talked about. He started playing in bands himself, you know, is way up in Sweden. This stuff spread all over the world, you know, so it managed to get a lot of people kind of drawn into that. They started listening to what these rock stars were saying, and it was all about this and that and the other. But if you can manage to kind of dislodge them from some of the things within our society, then that's going to be a very, very beneficial agenda, really, to the global elite of a first step towards a move in a direction where less and less people actually care about what really is happening in the world, and instead are actually, you know, focused on more mundane issues. It becomes kind of a narcissistic in a way. You know, it's really just self-absorbed. It's all about, you know, the sex and the drugs and the music, and then, you know, then that's it. There's nothing really more than that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the country is in Western civilization in general, I presume, is definitely grown far more apathetic over the last 4 or 5 decades. There really has been nothing resembling a protest movement really since the 60s. That all seemed to have kind of died out, and you know, I mean, there's like no political activism really on college campuses anymore at all. There's no anti-war movement. You never hear of any campus demonstrations or anything, despite the fact that we've been in, I don't even know how many successive wars now over the last, whatever, 10, 15 years. I mean, we had supposedly this Vietnam syndrome that lasted for a couple decades after Vietnam, where the American people were just completely sour on war and not interested in getting behind that sort of thing. And now, I mean, they can just launch a war on a whim now, you know, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan or smaller skirmishes elsewhere. They can go in militarily anywhere they want in the world these days on the flimsiest of pretexts, and there's nothing. There's not a ripple of protest on college campuses or whatnot. It's really sad that this generation is incredibly apathetic about what's going on in the world. And I mean, with all this stuff that's happened post 9/11, you know, I mean, all these police state measures, the militarization of and growth of the police state and wholesale attacks on privacy rights and civil rights and due process rights and everything else, and multiple wars being waged there's just so much out there for this generation of kids to be up in arms about, and yet there's no indication whatsoever that there's any real level of political activism among the youth of this country anymore. It's tragic. It really is.
Yeah, and then you start looking into some of them, and you realize, you know, who's pulling the strings of the Occupy movement, and who's doing this and that. It's all very much kind of celebrity driven, and you know, it's very.
The Move On and the Occupy, I mean, I don't even consider those real movements.
Most of them are just socialists anyway. They're just communists coming out of the woodwork. And that's how is that going to fix any of the problems that we have, you know? So it's coming from Sweden, living in that environment for all my life, you know, I'm just like so saddened to see when these people in America think that that's the way to go, you know? And that's the only dialectical oppositional movement that seems to be gaining some ground right now, and it's just horrible to see that, actually.
Yeah, I've been there once, by the way. I spent a couple of days in your country many years ago.
There you go.
Just in Stockholm. I was there for like a day and a half because it was a cruise stop, so we were only there for as long as the ship was in port.
Right.
And beautiful country, just incredibly all of Northern Europe. We went through Sweden and Finland and Norway and Holland and Denmark just such a sea change from LA, you know. Everything's clean and the people are so fresh faced and friendly. And
when were you there? Do you remember the year?
Oh, I'm gonna say it's probably been 20 years now.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I think my middle daughter was like one or two, and she's 21 now. So yeah, it was about 20 years ago.
20 years ago. Well, it's a different place today. Let me tell you, if you would revisit, you wouldn't recognize where you were.
Really?
Yeah, you wouldn't even know where they were in Sweden.
It was so weird to me because all the people were there were so friendly, and most of them speak English, and
sure,
you know, you could just like approach anyone on the street as a tourist, and you know, if you're lost and ask directions, or and people would not only give us directions, they would literally take the time out of their day to walk us to our, oh, let me take you, you know, walk us to our, and the whole time I'm thinking, this is so weird, you know, if somebody came in to say New York and approach somebody in a foreign language to ask directions, they're not going to get that response. They're going to get out of my face, you dumb fool.
Sure.
Learn to speak English. Yeah. That's what you're going to get in America, you know?
Well, they're sick. Not everywhere. This is the thing, though. I mean, I got to say, too, though, after living in Sweden for many years and then being over and visiting the U.S., you know, it's like, I experienced that Americans are tremendously warm. And I mean, again, it depends on where you go. I have to be clear about that. I haven't landed in this, you know, in downtown New York and tried it there, but everywhere else I've gone in America, including being over in California, a little bit on the East Coast and stuff, people are really friendly. And now it's kind of a reversal. It's a very isolationist over in Sweden right now. And, you know, a lot of problems that have arisen because of multiculturalism as well. So people get actually, it gets kind of a hyper-individualized society where people become really closed off, unfortunately. And we've had just such a huge problem with mass immigration that it's really just going downhill the last 20 years. And I mean, if you would visit there today, you wouldn't even recognize where you were.
Really? Maybe I'm just jaded because I've lived my whole life in L.A., born and raised here.
It's, yeah, that could be.
I don't know any better than this hideously seedy, synthetic, you know, hopelessly superficial
right
town that I live in here. Yeah. So
I don't think LA is not representative of the rest of America.
LA is not representative of the country, and no. I realize that all the time when I, you know, but you know, you live here your whole life, you tend to think in that way. But yeah, the reality is that most parts of America are completely, completely different than what I've grown up with.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, my perspective is a little jaded, to say the least. So.
That's why we get out and travel a little bit, right? So you can actually get a different feel. And then when you come back home, you get a new perspective on that too. So it's really important, you know, to do that.
Yeah, I haven't been able to late. It's been a while since I really miss doing so. But I highly recommend to anybody that can afford it that they get a passport and travel outside the country every now and then, see how the rest of the world lives. It's
exactly. I agree. It's really, really rewarding in that regard. Now let's talk a little bit about one of the other chapters that you had as well. I wanted to get into a little bit more what you thought about the other music scenes that kind of arose after that. You had in the Won't Get Fooled Again, you talked a little bit more about punk, the new wave, etc. Have you looked into that in more detail? Where did you go in that regard, in that chapter?
I have not. I've been tempted to. I get email and Facebook posts and whatnot all the time from people telling me that, hey, you know, you need to do this exact same thing with the British Invasion bands.
Right.
And tell us a story. Or, hey, you need to do the same thing with the Seattle scene and let us know what was going on. Or, hey, you guys need to do this with the punk and new wave scene. And, you know, and it's interesting. And I'm sure that there's just as interesting a stories to be told about all those scenes as there are about the Laurel Canyon scene. But, you know, I mean, I spent 7 years, as I said, working on this one, and there's only so many hours in the day and so many years left in my life, and I have a lot of other things that I'm interested in. So whether I'm going to devote the rest of my life to digging through the all these other scenes is you know, I'd love to see other people take it on, you know, because I'm sure there are books there, but whether I'm going to go any deeper or not, I don't know. But I did go into the punk and new wave scene to some extent because that was really the scene that the Laurel Canyon kind of gave way to in the late 70s, early 80s, as the whole Laurel Canyon scene started to fade out. The punk and new wave became all the rage and took over the radio dials and whatnot. So I did look a little bit into that to see, you know, exactly where that came from, since it was sort of the immediate successor to the Laurel Canyon scene. And what I found was that one family in particular played a remarkably influential role in handling a lot of these bands, in managing, recording, producing, booking, and just basically handling all aspects of their careers. The work of one particular family, the Copeland family, which was a very high-ranking intelligence family. The father, Miles Copeland, was a career CIA officer, and his wife was an equally highly placed British intelligence operative.
You know, my wife used to work for what's the first name? Miles Copeland. That's right.
Really?
Yeah.
Miles Axe Copeland. That was the father, Miles Axe Copeland Jr., actually, and then his three sons were Miles Copeland III, Stuart Copeland, and Ian Copeland.
Mm-hmm.
And Stuart Copeland put together what became the most commercially successful and critically acclaimed of the new wave bands, which was the Police, and the other two formed up production companies and booking companies and all of that, and handled all the behind the scenes work for a remarkable percentage of it's just astounding how many of these bands were this one family played a key role really in putting on the map. So yeah. I did go into it to that extent. I did not go into each individual band to find out what the backgrounds were of all of the leading characters from all these bands, and I'm sure that there's a lot of good stuff in there, but I did not dig that. I just didn't have time to dig that deeply. But what I did find was how much how behind the scenes control this one particular family seemed to have launching and shaping and sustaining that scene.
Yeah, isn't that fascinating, though, how so few hands can control and wield so much power? Because, I mean, ultimately, this is about the power of, I mean, it's not about swords and, well, certainly sometimes it's about, guns and weapons and armory and everything else, but it's most times it's about wielding the mind of the masses, right? That's what this is about, social engineering.
It's mind war. It's psychological warfare, which is just a huge part of our everyday existence anymore. I mean, a lot of what we see on the news and what we read in the paper is basically a form of psychological warfare. We're being conditioned more and more to accept ever greater levels of interpersonal violence. Through TVs, movies, video games, and whatnot. Yeah. We're being conditioned to accept a far more militarized police presence. To accept open use of basically there's hardly a dividing line here. I don't know what it's like over there, but I mean there's barely a dividing line here anymore between the police and the military.
Sure, exactly.
You see footage on TV and you don't know if they're making a sweep through a neighborhood in Boston or whether they're going on a search and patrol mission in Afghanistan. the tactics, the armor, the uniforms, the weaponry, it's all the same now. There's no defining line really between them, and we're very much being conditioned more and more to accept that as necessary, as not only necessary but actually a good thing. There's a lot of conditioning going on, a lot of, like I say, psychological warfare. They've been working on it for decades. These people are very smart, and they've had a lot of time to work on this. They've had a big head start on us, so they know what they're doing, and they know how to influence public opinion. They know how to influence the public consciousness, and they use those tools very effectively.
Oh, definitely. They've been studying us for decades, if not centuries now, in terms of, psychology, in terms of what, how we respond to certain things and TV and media and everything else. So how do you encourage people not to be dragged into the I guess the allure? I mean, I don't know what the pool is in some regards. I mean, I can't stand, I'd figure that the music that arrived in the 60s were kind of on the same par of what pop music is today. It was the pop music of the time arriving to the, onto the scene in that regard. And I've never been mesmerized with it, but so many people seem to be. Millions are attracted to this stuff. But how do you encourage people not to be manipulated by all of this, not be dragged into it? How do we get people to actually step away from this kind of stuff?
You know, that's a good question. You know, it's such an entertainment and celebrity driven culture that we live in anymore, you know, and that's another thing. There's no dividing line really between actual news and entertainment anymore. It's all kind of intermingled, you know, and it's very much a celebrity driven and entertainment driven culture that we live in. And, so how do you know, I don't know, you know, I really, I don't know how you break that hold, how you, you know, mitigate that influence. It's a good question and I wish I had a good answer for it, but, yeah, I don't know that I really do.
Yeah. I'm continually looking into this kind of area too. I'd suggest a kind of a cultural connectivity and actually attaining some kind of level of roots, because to me what these movements have been about has been about separating people from whatever has been before, and the most effective tool have been to do this with in some cases it's just kind of sexuality, but in some cases it's more, you know, bells and whistles, right? It's like a big carnival, all of it, to a certain extent. I mean, look at the close of the hippie era. It was all about, you know, those bright colors, kind of interacting with the drugs, of course, to a certain extent, but, you know, just kind of creating that environment of just newness, and people are unfortunately attracted and drawn to it because they've been long, long gone severed from their cultural roots, their ancestry, some kind of a tradition. And I mean, I know that's even more difficult perhaps in America because of the fact that there's, you know, it's such a corporate culture in that regard in these days, and more people are disconnected from their, wherever they come from, in other parts of the world, even if that's European roots or, you know, any other continent around the world. So that's what I think this is about. It's about actually reconnecting to something which is, you know, real, and something which is based in nature, something which is based in reality, you know, and disconnect from this kind of facsimile and fraudulent artificial culture that we've been brought up in. That's my key there, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we are definitely conditioned to follow our idols. There's no question about it. And if you look at the fashions from the 60s, they look pretty hideous now, you know. You know, my teen years were in the 70s when the hippie fashions had all been kind of mainstreamed, and it was almost impossible to buy a pair of jeans in those days that wasn't flare legged or bell bottom, you know, or right. Buy a shirt that wasn't paisley. And and you know, you look back at now and they're pretty hideous, but you know, yeah, we follow the leaders, you know. I mean, if our icons grow their hair out, we grow our hair out. If our icons dress in a certain way, we dress in a certain way. Nowadays it's tattoos, man. I mean, yeah. It's just astounding to me how much ink people are putting on their bodies these days. You know, kids, they seem like they can't wait to turn 18 so they can run out and get a tattoo. Two of my daughters did as soon as they turned 18. I tried to talk them out of it, but, you know, what am I going to do? They're adults. I tried to tell them, I mean, do you really think that something you're putting on your body now is is going to be attractive to you? You know, I mean, the kind of stuff that I was into when I was 18, if I had tattooed that stuff on my body, I would be so embarrassed now, you know, or paying somebody thousands of dollars to get it off. But, yeah, I mean, we're conditioned to follow our icons, you know, and they use that against us.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. So, yeah. Yeah, sever the connection to those idols, and also I think a lot of it is about discovery and research and investigating and actually looking in, learning. It's about any kind of phobia almost that you have. It's like, oh, it's only get better if you're actually going to learn about it and really look into it and to try to kind of disarm your fear for it in a certain extent. I think it's the same way here. It's like you have to disarm the idols and look what's behind them, who's controlling them, you know, as you said, with all the handlers and everything else. When you see how fake everything is, I mean, the allure will be instantaneously gone, I think, because it's all mesmerizing, it's all hypnotic in these days, you know. So if you can shine a light on it of truth and accuracy, I think the allure will be gone pretty quick. So all we can appeal to, I guess, is to people to actually really look into who these people are, where they come from, who's pulling the strings, and I think the rest will kind of fall apart from there, actually.
Yeah, one of the consequences for this to me has been a a serious lessening of my entertainment options, you know,
Oh,
because
yeah.
it's harder and harder for me to enjoy certain types of, you know, various types of entertainment anymore. And
Yep.
because I've done research into Hollywood in general as well, and the whole seedy backdrop of the whole just Hollywood in general, and all of these curious deaths and goings on that have been going on for decades in Hollywood, and you know, allegations of you know, these organized child abuse rings and
Sure.
whatnot
Yeah.
that are even flaring up now with, you know, Bryan Singer and whatnot. And you know, the more I find out about it, the more it reveals, well, okay, I guess I can't go see any more of his movies, you know, because all I'm going to be thinking about is the, you know, all these,
Yeah,
you
exactly.
know, all, you know, well, I guess no more Woody Allen movies. I guess no more Bryan Singer movies.
Never.
I guess
Yeah.
no more Doors albums. And, you know, it's just like my entertainment options are slowly but surely disappearing more and more
Yeah.
as it becomes harder and harder to, because I mean, the essence of entertainment is to be able to just sort of detach and turn off your brain and be, you know, kind of taken into this fantasy world. And I can't do that anymore in a lot of cases. You
See,
know?
this is it. This is actually where they. This is where the most weaponized propaganda lies in entertainment. This is because just because of the reason you mentioned, people walk into the movie theater or they, you know, sit down to watch a movie at home or even listen to an album or something. That's actually when they drop their guard. And I think that the social engineers have realized this and thought, okay, yep, that's the time to strike. That's the time to take it. I mean, we're doing studies right now as well, watching entertainment, watching a lot of movies and TV shows for the purposes of analyzing them. And I mean, oh my God, you wouldn't believe how much crap there is in this stuff. And I mean, if people don't watch this with a critical mind, they're going to be completely and utterly programmed by this stuff. It's just horrendous what's going on, you know?
Yeah, and it's getting more and more refined. I mean, they've been developing, refining this technology for a very, very long time. And you know, it's unless we start to wake up pretty soon, it's only going to get progressively worse. So
yeah, that's right.
You know.
All right. Well, this has been a very interesting discussion. I want to thank you very much, Dave McGowan, for your time today. Please let us know if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with. Maybe some other important notes or something out of the book that we should know. If not, give us, of course, the website addresses again where people can connect with you and where people can pick up copies of the book.
The website addresses, once again, are www.davesweb.cnchost.com. That is my main website that I've been running for very many years. The original Laurel Canyon articles that gave birth to the book are no longer up because of copyright issues. But I do have all kinds of other material there that's available for the taking, perfectly free. My new series on Lincoln, a series on the Boston Marathon, 911 stuff. Just all kinds of stuff there that you can get samples and you know, see if my writing is something that appeals to you. And you know, and as I said, there's the order page there for the book. I'm actually selling signed copies of my previous book also. So, and offering a package deal if for people that want to get both, a special discounted price to ship both together. So that's all on my website. And then again, the Facebook page is facebook.com/weirdscenesinsidethecanyon. And that is where I'm keeping all the most recent updates on the books as far as my appearances and interviews and all of that kind of stuff. And I think that's about all I have for now.
Yeah, all right. No, very good. Very good stuff, Dave. Really appreciate this. Again, on the book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. Check that out. And then the other book, as you mentioned there, is called Programmed to Kill. And yeah, maybe we can have you back in again in the future. We could talk about that and everything else in terms of the things we didn't get into in terms of the mass media, the culture, and the suicides and the mass murder. You've looked into a lot of interesting stuff, and you have a lot of interesting material on your website as well that I urge people to check out. So maybe we can pick that up at another time, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, there really is a lot of stuff interwoven into this book. It was kind of difficult to write, actually, because there's so many sort of interconnecting lines and themes that is it's a story that's almost impossible to tell in a linear fashion because it kind of just keeps looping back upon itself, you know? So there's just tons and tons of curious connections and like serial killer connections and all kinds of unexplained deaths and just a lot of interconnected weirdness in the book. So yeah, it's really hard to cover it all in any, you know, given interview. So, I think, listeners got a pretty good taste of what they will find there. So, and we don't want to, you always got to leave them wanting more, right?
You can't. Yeah, exactly. Everything. Yeah. Of course there's a lot, there's a lot of stuff in the book and I urge people to do, check it out because there's a lot of interesting connections there between, and a lot of things we didn't get to as well today, details and everything else. So yeah, good job. Thank you again, Dave. Really appreciate your time and keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. I had a good time and yeah, hopefully we can do it again sometime.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. That's our program for today. We have upcoming Gregory Sams, E. Michael Jones, Stephen McNallan, and Kyle Hunt, to name a few. Thank you for your time today, folks, and thank you so much for being a member and for your continued support. We'll talk to you soon. Have a great rest of your day or evening, and thank you for listening.